In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, here's a word about a Sunday news feature prepared for you by NBC. It's a program called Weekend, and it's a two-hour Sunday newspaper designed to bring you all the news of the week gone by, including important items you may have missed in the busy midweek rush. From front page to editorial page, from baseball news to fashion news, you'll hear it all on Weekend with Leon Pearson, Tex and Jinx, and many other outstanding reporters. It's more news coverage at its best by NBC. Hear Weekend every Sunday. Now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
Ike says no preventive war.
The Reds get a new spokesman.
Lower cost of living? Ike's farm bill confuses politics.
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight, you will hear from Ray Shearer, Arthur Berrio, Lee Feed, and Earl Godwin. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. We bring you now Keys to the Capitol, and first, here's NBC's White House correspondent Ray Shearer.
One of the striking contrasts in the world political situation today, it seems to me, is the British and American attitude toward the communist world. Now consider this. In Britain, the eight most prominent members of the British Labour Party have taken off on what appears to be a goodwill tour to Moscow and Beijing. They're out to see if peaceful coexistence with Soviet Russia is possible.
And they're giving the red carpet and the vodka treatment all along the circuit a tremendous welcome from the Kremlin. Now, over here, we have General Mark Clark saying it is a good thing to break relations with Russia now.
Not only that, but turning the United Nations into an anti-Soviet coalition. Senator McCarthy has again said that one of the principal issues of the campaign this fall, is going to be aid to allies who trade with Red China. Herbert Hoover, in his birthday speech, blamed most of our troubles on recognizing the Soviet Union some 20 years ago. There, then, is the contrast. Prominent Britishers on their way to Beijing, America dead set against having anything to do with the Red Communists. One of our most celebrated generals coming out for breaking relations with Russia. The president touched on all these things at his news conference, and as you might expect, took the middle course. He said it would not serve our purposes to break relations with Russia, said the only hope for peace in the world is improving the United Nations. Here was a striking example of the man Eisenhower in his role as conciliator, as a pacifier. And when he was asked to comment on the possibility of a preventive war, such as Sigmund Rhee advocated last week, the president was even more firm. He said preventive war was an impossibility today. Nuclear bombs would wipe out whole cities. He did not believe there is such a thing as a preventive war, and he wouldn't listen to anybody who advocated such a course of action. So said the president. But a lot of people, nevertheless, seem to think that since a war with the communist powers is inevitable, why not take them on now before they get too powerful and have too many bombs? What about that, Leafy?
Well, Ray, I suppose that is assuming that you can knock the other fellow out with a shot of H-bomb. But in these days, if you use the H-bomb on the other fellow, you probably wouldn't knock him out and you'd get an H-bomb treatment yourself right back. So then you'd get into a full-scale war, and with the weapons, I suppose, that you've got now that you would finally be drawn into a war in which there are both masses of armors and hydrogen bombs and all other sort of things, and you'd probably wind up with wiping civilization off the earth.
You pretty much agree with the president. There is no such thing as preventive war.
I don't see how there can be a preventive war unless you're sure of knocking the other fellow out completely with one fell swoop.
Arterio,
we heard Mr. Rhee at a luncheon last week, Ray, and I felt extremely sorry. The old gentleman, I really did, and sort of pitied him. He, at the same time, I thought he was a trifle optimistic. He said, as I recall, that there are some 600 million Chinese involved over there in the Far East, but that he thought if we took action, that is, in driving the Reds out of Northern Korea, that these 600 million Chinese are not necessarily communist Chinese, and that therefore he did not believe, he thought they were working in the underground, they are working against the commies themselves, and he couldn't see how an all-out war would result from that. Well, I am no international expert, but I don't see how we could possibly take any action, prevent a war otherwise, and not draw ourselves into a great conflict in which the atom bombs and the hydrogen bombs would fall over here as well as over there. I don't know. Earl, how about you? Do you have any ideas on it?
You're an old friend of Sigmund Rhee, Earl. You know how his mind works. Well, Does he really believe this stuff?
Sigmund Rhee is probably purely a patriot. I don't suppose there's anybody on Earth living today that is more of a complete patriot than Sigmund Rhee, and I think that possibly sometimes his judgment on this war issue is confused by the matter of patriotism. He sees half of his country has been stolen away from him by the Red North Koreans, the Red Chinese, and he can see nothing better than something that will wipe out that Red influence from the top of his country. Now, I can agree with anybody that says that there can't be anything these days such as a preventive war, because any war right now would prevent civilization. That's all. It would just knock out everything. It wouldn't be any war to make things better. No war is going to make anything better.
You know that Sigmund Rhee sort of summed up all the arguments for preventive war in his speeches in this country when he said, of course, that some people over here had got a little cold feet. He had 1.5 million South Koreans who were ready to join a half million nationalist Chinese. And he said, if the Russians jumped in, that would be all the better, because then we could
retaliate
against the Russians and wipe out their production sources before they could get a whole big stock of H-bombs. But the stockpile of H-bombs is not so very important. You can have 1,000 H-bombs on your side, and if the other fellow's got about 5 or 12, he's got you stymied.
I think it's one obvious point that we haven't brought up here, and that is that I don't think any of us believe that we should be soft toward the Russians, or soft toward the commies, or anything of the sort.
Pardon me, did I interrupt you?
No, I'm just going to say that we're not going to be soft toward the commies, or soft toward any of them over there.
But at the same time, we're not going to start a war. Within the last 2 days, has said the Russians are not going to start any hot war now. They're doing too well in the Cold War.
They are doing extremely well in the Cold War. Since democracy does have a certain moral code, I think it's impossible for us to strike first in the preventive war.
Well, it seems to me we all agree then, gentlemen, that this moral code and technology, the fact that there are these horrible instantaneous weapons, has made people like thinkers like Sigmund Rhee sort of obsolete.
But it seems to me, he's an absolute ruler over in his own country. I mean, he does pretty much as he pleases.
But to advocate that on a world scale is not only impractical, but...
It seems to me that a lot of this talk about preventive war arises from the fact that we are frustrated because here things are happening in the world that we can't do anything about. And so we said, well, let's slap them down with the H-bomb. Beat them down somehow. But if they don't attack us, we're not going to attack them. That's part of the moral code of democracy. You don't start a slaughter among the democracies. And so they have the time if war comes, they will pick the time to do it. In the meantime, they're doing very well as it is, so there's no reason why they should go to war.
In the meantime, we sit back and watch them grow more powerful. Well, Arthur Berrio, I understand you've been looking into probably the world's most intriguing mystery of the moment. What about Dr. Otto John? Is he a communist or isn't he?
Quite a story, Ray. It would seem that we've received proof positive that West Germany's former security chief, Dr. Otto John, has neither hanged himself nor was he forced to go over to the communists. All rumors along these lines have been knocked askew by his appearance at a Soviet news conference, one at which there was standing room only. We're told he was nervous in the early stages of the conference, but regained his composure as time went on. At least he regained it sufficiently to make known a claim that he is not a communist, that he went over to the Reds in order to warn the world against what he calls American plans for a new war which would destroy Germany, and that when acting as West Germany's security chief, he was shocked to learn he was being investigated. Well, he learned this from an American counterintelligence agent, Wolfgang Herfer. Herfer, you might recall, committed suicide 3 days after John deserted to the Reds, and the American Army said there was no connection between the death and the disappearance. Well, this, briefly, is the background for 1954's outstanding cloak and dagger story. It does not include one additional fact that prior to the news conference, Chancellor Konrad Adenauer's government had offered the equivalent of $119,000 in rewards to anyone who could come forward with facts about the disappearance. But what of the damage to the West? John has expressed fear of a Nazi revival, something Adenauer vigorously denies, but a statement which nevertheless strengthens the hands of those who oppose the European defense community. True, John left behind him papers which would have been invaluable to the Reds. But through his position, he knows secrets of the West. He needs no notes in black and white to remind him of sensitive information. West German officials insist the damage he can cause is not as great as they first thought. Regardless, they must take stock. They must take a sort of psychological inventory to determine the effects of Dr. John's actions, not only on the minds of Germans, but on the minds of French leaders. Because in less than 2 weeks, the French National Assembly is to begin debate on ratification of EDC. The Reds, naturally, are trying to block it. So in presenting to the world the views of the former security chief through a carefully staged news conference, they've succeeded in making use of him in order to fire a major propaganda broadside. It now remains for our authorities to counter this propaganda. Already, they've denied flatly that the United States, as John charged, has any secret agreements with West Germany as part of the European Army plan. They describe as being as phony as a $3 bill his assertion that he was shocked at being investigated. They point out that every intelligence agent knows he's being watched by agents of his own as well as other governments. They call all of Dr. John's statements sheer Soviet propaganda. All the authorities will continue to argue about his value to the Reds. But arguments notwithstanding, this much is certain. His desertion rocked the West. It was a body blow to our diplomacy. How do you feel about it, gentlemen? It's an interesting story.
I feel exactly what you said in your last statement, that it just rocks the West. They won the trick on that, all right. They had a forward pass, and nobody was there to stop the runner.
You don't suppose Dr. John has gone over there as a counterintelligence agent, gone over there, and he's phoning all this stuff to come back to our side and report on the communists.
It would be a marvelous hope.
They got a little rosy on that one, huh?
Well, I think it is a little bit rosy, because apparently it's produced a first-class political crisis in West Germany. They had a special cabinet meeting today, and after which the acting chancellor came out and denounced Dr. John's statement as the usual communist line. But the socialists, who are very powerful in Germany, and also against EDC,
right,
are demanding a whole cabinet shakeup. And so there's likely to be a political shift there in the country, which is endangering the thing that we're plugging for, the European defense community.
Undoubtedly, there's plenty of embarrassment today here in Washington. For example, our Central Intelligence Agency, which isn't, shall we say, given to putting out news releases, felt called upon to try to explain its version of it with a sheer propaganda assertion that it made. And I think that many officials, both here and abroad, wish that Dr. John had never risen to this position in the very beginning. To save a few red faces today.
Well, there were some divergent opinions on this, of course. I don't know whether our people were very strong for Dr. John in the beginning. And the French were certainly opposed to him. The French never did trust him. So they can come along and say, well, look, the fellow that we were against was pretty turned sour. And our people, so far as I understand, have always been skittish about dealing with Dr. John, having anything to do with him.
He never has seemed too reliable.
Our people never did consider him very reliable. But on the other hand, when he came over here, he talked with J. Edgar Hoover and Alan Dulles, although they didn't tell him anything. It still looks bad.
They didn't have to tell him anything.
They had to do was have him to lunch or have him in for a conference.
They didn't tell him anything at all. They knew exactly where he stood with it. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that they could read his mind on whatever this thing is, or this is treachery or not, but they simply treated him as a must item. They had to take him to lunch.
He was a VIP here, and he had to be received, that's all.
Yeah. He was here, so they went out with him.
But that makes propaganda for his time. Okay. He can say, when I was talking with Dulles, I got clearly from him that we were starting a Third World War and so forth, which he did today.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting back to the Dr. John's motivation. Incidentally, I don't know that he did see Hoover. He did talk to Dulles.
He did talk to Hoover, didn't he?
I'm not sure that he did.
Oh, you're the authority.
I know that he talked to Dulles. I'm not sure.
Well, it seems to me that he did talk.
Be that as it may, I'd like to raise the question, what happened to him? Was he brainwashed, or was he one of these confused idealists who went sour because he thought West Germany was going to the Nazis, or what? What started all this thing? What are your theories, Arthur?
Well, I don't know. The theory was offered today that he might have been brainwashed, but based on that conference he had this morning,
It takes a while to brainwash somebody.
It does. And the action would have been much too quick, I would think.
Well, I think the fact that our people were always a little bit suspicious of him and standoffish is some proof that they suspected or had good reason to believe that he was unstable. And then there was the reason they didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Why is this thing causing a crisis? And is the suspicion that if the powers that be in West Germany would trust a man like this, then their judgment is bad? Is that the way this is?
A mess.
He is the security. I would say it. He is the security chief, and if the security chief could go bad, what about the other men down
the
line?
That's what I mean. This is a symptom of a bad situation.
Yeah, a bad situation. They're responsible for him.
At any rate, it's a very unhappy situation, and sure gives the Reds another break propaganda-wise. But let's get on here. Leif, I understand you've been looking into the economics of the farm bill.
Yeah.
Which we've heard so much.
That's a very large subject. But let's do a little farming for a change. Well, the Senate passed the bill, so the president's going to get the kind of farm law that he wants. And today he said he seems very happy about it, very well satisfied with it. He didn't get all he asked for, but he did get that flexible principle written into both farm bills, the House's and the Senate's bill. I suppose a lot of people are wondering now about two things. First, whether this is going to be the answer to the long-lived farm problem. And second, whether it's going to make a big difference in our grocery bills. Well, I think the answer is no on both counts. But it's a short step in the direction that the administration thinks we ought to be going. A brief step toward letting supply and demand in the open market help the farmer decide what crops he should be planting. As the president said, the idea is to get the wheat, cotton, corn, and dairy farmers to producing for the market instead of farming the government. Something had to be done, of course. In the last year, Uncle Sam's investment in farm surpluses has just about doubled. And by the end of this crop year, it will have just about tripled to the tune of just about $10 billion taxpayer dollars. That's the way Secretary Benson figures it. For instance, Benson said that if we loaded all the surplus wheat the government has under loan now on a single train, railroad train, that train would extend all the way from San Francisco to New York and then back again to St. Louis. That's a lot of wheat. It's considerably more than we use ourselves and export in a whole year. Under this new law, Secretary Benson will have the power to cut the price supports on crops that we raise in surplus and to raise the price supports on crops that we're short of, if there are any. But that's not a great deal of flexibility. There's not much of flexibility that the president asked for. And wheat, for instance, Benson can cut the price supports down from 90% where they are now, 90% of the so-called parity, down to 82.5%. Well, the price support this year is about $2.25 a bushel. Next year, Benson, and the way I figure it around with my pencil, would be able to cut that to about $2.07 a bushel. Of course, the price in the open market will drop just about that much, too. So it's going to mean a sizable cut in some farmers' incomes. But by itself, this slight flexibility won't be enough to stop the surpluses from piling up still higher. It'll drive some marginal lands out of wheat production and probably some marginal wheat farmers. But the big ones can still raise wheat for a lot less than $2.07 a bushel. So Benson's still going to have to keep some mighty tough controls on both farm acreages and marketing. But as I say, the administration figures that this is a step, just a step in the right direction. The consumers don't need to look for any sharp drop in the cost of living. As the president has pointed out, this is a limited program for getting supply and demand in balance, gradually. So there's not going to be much year-to-year change. You take bread, for instance. The wheat in a loaf of bread now is worth less than 3 cents. If you cut the price of wheat a full third, that still would cut the cost of baking a loaf of bread by less than 1 cent. So by itself, this law is not going to make a great deal of difference in the cost of living. It still will be high as far as the so-called basic farm products are concerned. On the other things, it's a matter of supply and demand now, pretty much. And about the only way to bring those farm prices down much is to follow the late Senator Taft's advice. Eat less. But who wants to do that? Do you want to, Ray?
I'm hungry. Leaf, I'm not fully convinced. I know this is the key to their argument that lower supports will mean that the farmer is going to raise less. If he gets less for the stuff he raises, isn't he liable to raise more to make up the difference?
Well, you see, Benson's going to clamp on very tight controls. As a matter of fact, he's clamping on the tightest controls on the farmers we've ever had. And in order to get price supports on one product, you've got to live up to all restrictions on all farm crops that are under control. They used to, if they had wheat and they agreed to cut their acreage, say, 10%. Well, then they'd use that 10% to raise, corn or soybean or cotton or something like that, so that you got wheat planted all over the country. You cut in one part, and another farmer in another section of the country would start raising wheat because he wasn't under that control. But he's under these new tight controls, they're going to cut all acreages.
What this means,
about
then,
10% of the farmland of the country is going to go out of production.
This means more regimentation than ever for the farmer, doesn't it?
More regimentation than ever until this system really gets flexible.
Until
they can use the market, the cash price to determine what a farmer is going to produce.
Leaf, in your studies of this scene, have you ever found out why they put peanuts as a basic crop? There are five basic crops: wheat, cotton, corn, what is rice, and peanuts.
Yeah.
Why peanuts?
Why peanuts?
Yeah.
I'll answer that for the same reason that rice is.
Well, the peanuts.
why rice?
I've heard of peanut politicians without any rice politicians.
There are. I mean, the economists have a word for these six so-called basic crops. They call them the political crops.
There are five, aren't they?
Well, there's
six
of them.
Is cotton in there?
The tobacco's in there.
Oh, tobacco's in there.
Sure,
yeah.
Tobacco's
a separate
ruling,
isn't it? Well, being from Virginia, I would stand up for support prices on tobacco. That's the way.
What about peanuts?
The world, wouldn't
Are you going to go back on peanuts?
No, I'm not going to go back on peanuts, but I've often wondered why they had it there, because it's a small sectional crop.
Well, if you suspect that there's some politics in this, why don't you go on with it? Political
speak of it
here.
Just for a second.
You go ahead. Bring it on. Let's hear something about the politics.
Well, I'll tell you this issue of flexible versus rigid support, something that many people don't understand. But anyhow, talking on Capitol Hill today and yesterday, you would find that many people think the subject might change, might have a terrific effect upon the election this fall. For instance, a Midwest farm leading Republican lawmaker said to me today, the Eisenhower farm program is not doing us Republicans any good. And in the same corridor, in the office building, I heard jubilant Democrats predict that the farm issue, plus a few other issues, are going to bring in 50 new Democrats in the House next time. And if so, that will not only carry the House, but it will swamp the Capitol. That's all there is to it. I quoted that to a Republican leader, and he said, shucks, the Democrats always have the election won in August. So you can see it's hot stuff up on the Capitol Hill right now. But in any farm state, you find divided opinions. The city folks in the farm states are not all for the high and rigid supports at all. Therefore, the polls in those newspapers out there show that, we will say Minnesota, that's one state where city Republicans are for the flexible, they're for the Eisenhower program. They seem to think that it's going to have some effect on reducing food prices, and Leafy discussed that pretty well. And then there are certain farmers that don't like rigid price supports at all, because they have to buy stuff. They have to buy wheat, chicken feed, and cattle feed for cattle and chickens, which is their farm stuff. There's no farm support and no support prices on any livestock, on chickens or eggs or anything of that kind, and they complain that when they buy their chicken feed like I do, I thought I was picking up the tab at the New York nightclub, feeding these chickens on that high price. So You see, it works both ways. The administration's got to make some explanation of this, though.
What's that, Earl?
Eisenhower made a pledge October 4, 1952, out there in a South Dakota town named Brookings.
Brookings, I was there.
And here's what he said. I've got the full quote, but here's a sentence. The Republican Party is pledged to the sustaining of the 90% parity price support and is pledged even more than that to helping the farmer obtain his full parity, 100% parity, with the guarantee in price supports of 90. Now, he made that statement, and that is, and that's being circulated all through the price support.
He explained himself rather vehemently in a news conference about 6 weeks ago. He said that if you check back, you will find that he said 100% parity in the marketplace.
Well, I saw the text of the of that speech, and I don't know whether it was a White House text or whether it was a Republican National Committee, but it was in the hands of a Republican who's going to support Mr. Eisenhower, but who is going to run on his own platform. A lot of them will be that do that. They run on their own farm platform.
Sure.
And if there's time, I will read you 7 or 8 lines of that.
Well, that phrase marketplace was in there, and that's the key to the whole thing.
There's no marketplace in here.
He even talked about this several times, as I remember it, and he said they were going to try to help the farmer get 100% of parity. He said if 90% of parity was good, 100% was better. Wasn't that the opening gun in that thing?
Unless that Minnesota Kasten.
In my mind, yeah.
Kasten, Minnesota.
Was that the official text, Earl?
This is official. It's handed to me by a Republican from a wheat state, and his secretary wrote it for me, and I don't know whether he got it from the White House or the Republican National Committee or what, but here it is. Quite naturally, in a great region such as this, there is more of a special interest in agriculture than there is in some of our other economic forms of life. I have, in a number of texts during this campaign, tried to outline the specific position of the Republican Party and my own personal conviction about agriculture. At Kasten in Minnesota some weeks back, later in Omaha, and in a number of so-called back platform speeches, I have tried to make my position clear. The Republican Party is pledged to the sustaining of the 90% parity price support, and it is pledged even more than that to helping the farmer obtain his full parity, period, 100% parity with the guarantee in price support of 90. Now, if that is incorrect, it should be corrected.
As I say, he corrected it in his news conference, and if you could see the fire in his eyes, you know that he was pretty terrible.
Well, it might be. Now, I don't read this. I read this as a reporter, not to me.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's an interesting thing, and it is being made use of in the wheat and corn belt.
I was just going to say it might have been corrected, but it seems to me that if they want to explain it, they're going to have to emphasize it even further and get it out there in the farm country.
I got this out of the office of a farm belt Republican who
was not entirely happy about the Eisenhower Farm Program, I suspect.
Well, let's take Carl Mundt, whom we know him. Everybody knows him now, but through these McCarthy hearings, he's up this year for re-election. And the polls and the newspapers in his state show that he can probably win, but not with a walk away. It's going to be tough, and the cities. The city folks are inclined to want the flexible price supports, which Mundt has said it won't do this time. It isn't the time for it. We've got to keep these rigid price supports until we loosen up things all through the rest of our economy. That's a single outstanding instance of a Republican in a Republican state that's having more trouble in his re-election campaign than he would otherwise.
Than he thought he was going to have.
Yeah, he thought he was going to have.
Normally a Republican would be a shoo-in and stuff.
Yeah, just walk away.
But, Earl, you know, the vote on the wheat controls and so forth and the price support, 90% price support, really swung on the two Dakotas. Up until the time it hit the Dakotas, it was pretty even. But then the Dakota farmers went way over to 90% price supports, and they really swung it.
You've been listening to Keys to the Capitol, transcribed and produced for radio by NBC News, as a way of taking you through the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Ray Scherer, Arthur Berrio, Lee Feed, and Earl Godwin. Keys to the Capitol will return next week at this same time. This is the NBC Radio Network.